It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, wearing it on your sleeve. Why fashion matters. So, Jackie, I have to ask, what are you wearing?
I am wearing a black boiled wool Cossack coat from the 1950s. It has a capelet. And this piece was actually a gift to me from my colleague, my NPR colleague, Renee Montaigne.
You might recognize that voice. It's Jackie Lydon, longtime foreign correspondent and host on NPR. But lately, she's switched from covering distant wars to creating her own startup, an independent podcast about fashion. It's called The Seams. Some of the segments have already aired on NPR. So, Jackie, why create a whole new program about fashion?
Well, I had to do something. So there was that. There was that little bit of impetus. But we had actually started The Seams last year. And here, Anne, is the biggest reason. I felt that in my years as a journalist here, I remember saying to one of my young colleagues, what do I do next? Because I had hosted a lot of shows. I'd done a jillion stories. And my young colleague said, Jackie, you should cover fashion. And I said, yes, but not hemlines and trends and seasons. Vogue can do that and does it really well, along with many other outlets. What we need to do is connect the anthropology of fashion to public radio audiences, to basically people who had questions that involve historical context or the significance or the memory of clothing. This tiny rural workshop represents one thread of a supply chain that loops from Mexico's plains, mountains, to catwalks, from Tokyo to Amsterdam. I've been brought to this back alley in Tenancingo, 2 hours from Mexico City, by one of the country's leading designers, Carla Fernandez. She takes these handmade textiles and manipulates them into something contemporary.
So this is a rebozo.
She unfurls a blue and white fringe shawl, intricately loomed into a tight herringbone pattern nearly 8 feet long.
You can use it as a vest, and then you can turn it, and you will see that it becomes more as a blouse or a sweater. And also, we leave the fringes of the rebozo, so you can actually see that this is all handmade.
You know, what's funny is I think I can probably count the number of stories I've heard about fashion or clothing on NPR on the fingers of one hand.
Yes, and I bet you I did about four of them. We used to never at NPR do stories about fashion. And indeed, if you ask NPR audiences, I know this because I looked at the research, do you care about fashion? 95% of them said no. But if you ask them, do you care about culture? 95% say yes. And I think what has been missing and the reason that people think they don't care about fashion, it's because it's told as a story of very shallow consumerism. If it is told as a story of memento, clothing that is specific to time and place and narrative, it just becomes a much wider and deeper conversation.
Now, your connection to fashion dates back a long way, right? I think, aren't you the daughter of a former runway model?
I'm the daughter of a former department store model. My mother used to model at Gimbel Schuster in Milwaukee back in the 1950s. In fact, I used to model with her.
You did? How old were you?
3. And I will say I don't specifically remember the modeling, but she was a great seamstress. She taught all 3 of her daughters to sew. I made all my clothes in high school and a lot of them in college. So the whole notion of making, wearing, significance, and history, for me, that was always a part of the world of clothing.
But so, Jackie, clearly you speak the language of clothing, but you're creating a podcast for the millions of us who do not speak the language of clothing and who are perfectly happy to get up in the morning and pull on the only pair of jeans that are still clean. So what would you, with your public radio editorial sensibility and your deep connection to the language of clothing, what would you want to cover instead?
So, for example, the first piece was 50 years of the Ebony Fashion Fair and how the co-founder of Ebony Magazine, Eunice Johnson, decides that she will go to Milan and Paris and acquire haute couture. She then turned around, took these gowns and items, which she had bought herself on those little gilded chairs over in Paris and Italy, and put it on young African-American men and women. And then she staged hundreds of catwalk shows around the United States. They would do it 10 months out of the year, and they did that for 50 years.
The Ebony Fashion Fair started in 1958 in the Grand Ballroom of Chicago's Conrad Hilton Hotel. Then it hit the road, from splashy big city venues to high school gyms and tiny whistle stops. The young models traveled by bus, with seats removed for their long legs, all over the country and throughout the Jim Crow South. Racial tensions were boiling over. A young woman from Vicksburg named Del Handy was with them then.
It almost felt like steam coming up from the pavement. You could just feel it. Our name was on our bus at one time, you know, Ebony Fashion Fair, and I remember them taking the name off the bus so as not to call attention.
Restaurants were off limits. John Johnson, Ebony's publisher, knew the models were aspirational figures, and he wanted them seen that way.
Mr. Johnson had said when we went down south that we could never go in the back door of the restaurant.
Instead, the white bus driver would go get takeout.
This is just one story. You know, the other thing that told us we were onto something was the number of museums that are doing fashion shows. Mm-hmm. And this has grown by leaps and bounds. When I say fashion shows, I'm talking about exhibits with fashion at the center, as Ebony was. Ebony started at the Chicago History Museum.
So what about, are there political or economic stories to tell about the seamy side of fashion? Child labor, Korean sweatshops, you know, stories about the production side of the textile and garment industry.
I think that we cannot ignore that. Clearly, that is the underbelly of particularly what is called fast fashion.
What do you mean fast fashion?
So fast fashion is what so many of us acquire today. H&M and Uniqlo are two of the biggest purveyors of fast fashion. Fashion that costs $5 as much as a cup of coffee, maybe less.
You're basically talking about it's the fast food of fashion.
Exactly. And they keep it moving through the stores and they change the merchandise around a lot. And that kind of cheap, fast fashion, first of all, it winds up in landfills often, you know, within a couple of years. And the human capital, the labor, is often very, very exploitive. So we shop for things that seem like they are good value to us. But what is the source of it?
Jackie, I'm curious, just trying to think ahead. Imagine that the kind of coverage you're talking about happens and becomes a wave, and that we all develop a kind of clothing and fashion literacy. What changes, do you think? What changes about what it's like to get dressed in the morning?
Well, I'm sure that you, Anne, have looked at wonderful pictures from back in the 1940s and 50s and how beautiful people looked. Now take a plane from LA to New York and take a good look around. We have taken the whole notion that our appearance doesn't matter kind of to, you know, a whole level that I think sort of devolves. And it isn't particularly
You're not somebody who wears sweatpants on airplanes, I take it.
And I don't, as a matter of fact. So I, you know, I'm not saying that there's no room for comfort. Of course there is. But there is a need for style. There's a need for the articulation of the spirit. There is a need to be bold when we're feeling like little mice. There is a need to stand out. These are deep human needs. And it doesn't mean that, you know, you take out your charge card. Fashion's aspirational, but it might also feel exclusive. Mm-hmm. And it isn't. It isn't. There isn't a human body type that can't have a sartorial significance.
Jackie Leiden is the host and founder of The Seams, a new reporting series and podcast about fashion. Of course, fashions change more than just the clothes on our backs. Philosopher Lars Svensson says fashions influence art, music, politics, and yes, even philosophy. He tackles the topic in his treatise, Fashion, a Philosophy. Steve Paulson, who dresses for radio, caught up with him to find out how fashion is significant.
Lars, you call the growth of fashion one of the most decisive events in world history. In fact, you say that you cannot understand the modern world without fashion. You really think fashion is that important?
I think it is. it didn't start out as being that important. I mean, fashion started in the area of clothing in the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance, in which something was seen for the first time in history, seeking novelty for the sake of novelty itself. Being new was a value. It's the first time we see that sort of logic. And then it started to spread into all other areas. So one could say that the logic of fashion, it has turned us all into neophiliacs. We love novelties.
Now, does this go back to newness in clothing? I mean, back to the Renaissance? I mean, did this whole craze for novelty begin with people wanting stylish clothing?
Yeah, that's where we see it starting. When people seek change for the sake of change itself. Prior to that, styles had been fairly stable. Basically, the cuts were the same among the rich and the poor. Only the rich, they had better materials, they had more ornamentation often, and so on. But you did not see this whole logic of change for the change itself. That really is not observed until the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance.
So why? I mean, why did people at that point crave change, crave distinctiveness?
It's really hard to say. It might be due to introduction of new secular values, the emergence of capitalism, and then as the bourgeoisie emerged and so on. And of course, also the emergence of the individual, which is this crucial historical figure. I mean, we think it's so obvious to think of ourselves as individuals, but we haven't always done so. And the individual is this character who takes him or herself as a completely unique human being who has to differentiate him or herself from others. This is a huge difference between traditional and non-traditional societies. In traditional societies, you really don't have to ask about who you are. You don't have to ask about the meaning of life because it's already defined for you. But when you start to move on to post-traditional or modern societies, all of this is loosened. The collective does not answer these questions for you anymore. So you have to show who you are as a completely unique individual, and wearing specific clothing and so on becomes a tool in highlighting that identity.
So clothing becomes a form of self-expression. It reveals something about who you are.
Yeah, and of course, that's a fairly common conception that clothing is this brilliant expressive medium. I beg to differ. I think that we are told that fashion is all about individualism, and it's about expressing who you are as a unique individual and so on. But I think that clothing, it's not particularly well-suited medium for expressing yourself. If you have something terribly important to say to the world, say it. Don't wear a specific t-shirt.
But I don't know, it's sort of easier. You don't know, it's just you can walk down the street and people can look at you and, you know, your clothing says something about you, right? Or the image that you want to project to the world.
It says something, but one thing it certainly does not say is who you are as this allegedly unique individual. Say if I were to wear a black suit and black shirt. Doesn't say anything about whether I'm a nice guy or a scumbag. Doesn't say anything on whether I'm to the political left or to the political right. Doesn't really say much about me as an individual. So I would say that whatever fashion is about, it's certainly not about genuine individuality.
And yet, billions of dollars are spent every year on fashion. I mean, this is a huge industry, but you're telling me that, you know, maybe it's kind of overblown here. Maybe, you know, we read more into it than is really there.
Oh, we certainly read a lot more into it. But consumption has become one of our main areas of self-formation. By buying something, we wish to express something to others and to ourselves as well, about who we are. But at the same time, the identity it can provide you with will also be worn out pretty fast. So it really doesn't provide much of a foundation for building a more substantial identity.
Well, I have to confess that I really don't think that much about clothes. As anyone who knows me can tell you, you know, looking at what I wear. But I've heard about this trend called normcore, which, if I understand it, it's very fashion-conscious people wearing very normal clothes. I mean, it could be, you know, L.L. Bean boots or a Lands' End sweater, or Levi's jeans, but doing it with intention. In other words, it means something for a 21-year-old in New York with a fancy haircut to wear this kind of stuff.
Yeah, but of course, that's already become a cliche. So if that had some symbolic potential, that you wanted to say something with it, I'd say that that potential has evaporated already. And it tends to do so fast. I mean, when grunge was big, it didn't take very long before you saw grunge outfits on the catwalks. When punk was big, I mean, it took less than a year before you had these fashion spreads in the British magazines about these really cool punk mothers and so on, and others could emulate that style and so on. And then it really loses all its symbolic significance. So that's another thing fashion does really efficiently. It drains all countercultural messages of meaning pretty instantly.
So what have you come out of this whole study of fashion, of sort of constructing a philosophy of fashion, that sort of, you know, have you come to any larger conclusions about what it all means?
Hard to say. I mean, I try to not be too moralistic about fashion. If people enjoy it, I mean, that's fine with me. But I think that it's being presented as something far more important to us than it actually is. On the other hand, it's extremely important because the whole logic there dictates so many things in various social areas. And of course, noticing that logic could perhaps provide us with some resistance towards it, that we do not necessarily have to crave something new simply because something else has gotten old and so on. But apart from that, I really cannot say that the study of fashion provided me with any groundbreaking insights into the meaning of life.
Lars Svensson is a philosopher who teaches at the University of Bergen in Norway. Coming up, can clothing be a force for good? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and we're talking about fashion in this hour. So even if you don't spend a lot of time thinking or worrying about what you wear, you still can't escape fashion. It's a trillion-dollar global industry that shapes everything, from ideas about beauty to notions of cool. Minha Pham is a professor at the Pratt Institute's Media Studies program, but on the side, she blogs about the fashion industry. And she says clothes can be a powerful lens on global culture. Raymond Tangakar caught up with her.
Minha, there are a lot of people out there that think that fashion is frivolous and it's not really worth serious consideration. I think I actually even read in one of your articles, there was a fashion journalist that said that over-intellectualizing fashion actually sucked the fun out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I take it you don't actually believe that, though. So make the case for us. Why should we be taking fashion seriously?
Well, to an extent, I would say, yes, over-intellectualizing anything sucks the fun out of it. but it's worth thinking about. Fashion is worth thinking about because it's really an avenue into so many different parts of our life and our society, right? So if we're interested in questions of culture and society, the economy, there's a case to be made that understanding fashion leads us to an understanding of how we work as humans, our motivations, our desires, our fantasies, our aspirations.
As we've been researching this show, I've been really struck at all these negative associations that people have. And, you know, at the same time, this is an industry that brings in billions of dollars every year.
That's right.
And it also informs how we present ourselves to the world. So why do you think there's so much hostility to fashion?
I get asked that question a lot, and my answer has often to do with a gender analysis of fashion. Fashion and so many other kinds of culture and practices that are traditionally associated with women and femininity are often seen as frivolous, right? So it's not just fashion, but also soap operas, for example, that are seen as frivolous and just not that important. So I think that that kind of hostility towards fashion and that dismissal of fashion is linked to a larger, a broader sexism in our culture that lingers.
I also wonder if an aversion to fashion is somehow related maybe to a certain amount of privilege, right? Because fashion is about self-expression, but at the same time, it's also about managing the perceptions that others have of you. When I'm buying a new shirt, this is what goes through my head. I'll think about whether it looks good, whether it's cheap, how it fits me. But there's also, there's this secondary thought that goes through my head, whether it makes me look more Asian, for example, or even if it makes me look like I'm trying to appear white.
Whatever that means, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so perhaps if you're averse to fashion, maybe you're in a position of luxury where you don't always have to think about what others think of you, or at least think about it excessively.
I see what you're saying. I think the idea that maybe white men don't have to worry about their appearance because their appearance, there's already kind of a taken-for-granted assumption that they are respectable, that they are legitimate, that they should be respected, right? And that people of color and other marginalized people don't have that privilege. And so that the attention to their appearance is often about survival in some way, about countering the negative perceptions that are often imposed on them. So I think that's true. But I also don't think that it's just white men or white straight men that view fashion as frivolous, right? That I think that this is actually not located in one group, but is part of a cultural and national sentiment that has more to do with the ways in which feminine activities and feminine cultures are devalued.
And you have a number of articles that also address the role of race in fashion and the fashion industry. And, you know, as we've heard, there have been discussions about the fashion industry's lack of diversity. And there's an article you wrote in which you talk about what you termed multicultural scenery.
Yeah.
Could you tell us what that means?
So in that article, I'm thinking about the ways in which we see people of color in fashion media, so that they mostly appear in fashion ads, for example, as a background, as a backdrop that suggests something about the brand's progressive, urban outlook. So people of color then in these ads that I'm talking about are props, right, that tell us nothing about the people themselves, but rather about the brand's kind of interest in or attention to diversity. When we see people of color as multicultural scenery, what that actually does is it re-centralizes the whiteness in fashion, because these people are there to support oftentimes the white models in the fashion images. They provide the frame around which whiteness is made central again.
And so what would it take to, I suppose, upend that and make whiteness not the central element of fashion?
It would take a lot more than a fashion ad. It would take a structural change. And that's one of the problems I think that the fashion industry has with diversity, is that there's just a general lack of understanding of what racial diversity really would mean. So that oftentimes the fashion media, fashion modeling agents, fashion designers, for example, attend to a number count, a body count. How many models of color are on the runway? How many models of color are in this ad? How many models of color are representing this brand as a spokesperson? in order to actually make real change, you would have to institute change in terms of, you know, who are the editors of major fashion magazines? Who are the directors of modeling agencies? How do we think about the beautiful body or the fashionable body in ways that are outside of the dominant images that we see of thin to the point of anorexic, thin, long-limbed, young white women, right? How do we think about beauty and fashion in larger ways so that the idea of being fashionable doesn't mean that unless you, you know, unless you fit a very narrow set of criteria, you're not beautiful, you're not fashionable.
Hmm. You're saying that it requires challenging our conceptions of beauty and actually
That's
including
right.
non-dominant bodies,
That's right.
races. But how do you do that on like a societal level, though?
Well, I think that work has already started. Now we have blogs, for example, that are celebrating and focusing on the very kinds of bodies that you almost never see in fashion magazines. And if you do, then oftentimes as, you know, as a prop or as a background piece. So that you have blogs devoted to larger women, you have blogs devoted to celebrating the bodies of disabled women. We see Asian bloggers all over the internet. We see a diversity of different bodies enjoying, celebrating, participating in fashion. So I think creating more so that that kind of standard, that ideal is actually just one among many ways of being beautiful or fashionable, mm-hmm. will start to shift our ideas of what beauty and fashion can look like.
So it sounds like you're saying that fashion serves as a really wonderful lens through which to view culture. I'm also wondering if it could be like an agent of social change.
I think it absolutely can be, and it has. Many marginalized communities historically and now continue to use fashion and fashion their bodies through clothes and accessories in ways that change the perception that others have about them. One of the ways that I talk about it with my students is to think about the politics of aesthetics, that aesthetics, the site of aesthetics, whether we're talking about fashion or hairstyle, has always been about a struggle over the meanings of Asianness, of blackness, of womanness. And so, you know, think about the Black is Beautiful movement and how the idea of styling black hair in a particular way, for example, or black clothes in a particular way, created a movement around the idea that black bodies should be valued.
Minha Pham teaches media studies at the Pratt Institute and also blogs about fashion. She's got a new book due out later this year called Asians Wear Clothes on the Internet: Race, Gender, and the Work of Personal Style Blogging. Back in 2013, more than 1,000 people died when a building collapsed in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Rana Plaza housed at least 5 garment factories. The people there were earning low wages, making cheap clothing for Western fashion chains. After the collapse, the global garment industry came under scrutiny for the human cost of so-called fast fashion. And that's a trend that swept malls and main streets, where clothing stores keep people perpetually shopping by offering new styles every couple weeks. Now, an alternative might be arising. Here's Sarah Nix talking with Elizabeth Klein about fashion, fast and slow.
So a couple years back, I went to a Kmart and bought a pair of $7 black canvas slip-on shoes. And they were so cheap that they just wore out immediately. I think I wore them out in a couple weeks. So I went back to the store and bought the store out of my size. I bought 7 pairs of $7 shoes. And that for me was kind of a wake-up call. But I had been thinking about my closet and my shopping habits for a while, because I, like a lot of people, I attempt to be a conscious consumer. You know, I recycle, I ride my bike when I can, I take public transportation, I try to buy organic food. But then when I would look in my closet, there was absolutely no reflection or thought. I had no idea where my clothes came from, who made them, how they were made. And on top of it, I just had a lot of them. And I had a lot of stuff that I wasn't wearing. I had somehow over the years developed this very transient disposable attitude towards clothing. And that's really what set me on the path to kind of find out how cheap fast fashion had taken over not only my closet, but the closets of every single person that I knew.
And so on that journey, you went to Bangladesh, you went to China, you visited places where these fast fashions are being made. What did you see?
I think two of the most astonishing things I learned on my trip to China and Bangladesh was, first of all, the scale of the global garment industry. In Bangladesh alone, which is one very popular spot for producing clothing now, there's more than 5 million garment workers. In China alone, I'm pretty sure there's over 10 million garment workers. So
wow.
There was this one area in southern China where on either side of the highway, I could see thousands and thousands and thousands of factories. They stretched as far as the eye could see. And the factories were enshrouded in this cloud of pollution. So there are entire cities, districts, tens of millions of people in southern China who are churning out all these consumer goods at an enormous cost to the environment. And it's completely hidden from view from American consumers.
And there has been over the past 10 years this growing demand for ethically produced products, environmentally responsible products. You talked about organic food. How have fashion retailers addressed that demand?
I think that there's been a pretty dramatic growth in the ethical fashion movement or the slow fashion movement. Even since Overdress was released, the hardcover came out in 2012 and the paperback came out in 2013. And I remember when I finished the book feeling kind of frustrated at the lack of alternatives. And since then, there's been a lot of movement toward rethinking and improving the way the global fashion industry runs. And a lot of that had to do with the collapse of Rana Plaza in Bangladesh in 2013, when over 1,000 garment workers lost their lives. I think for a lot of consumers, that was a real wake-up call and a turning point. And I think the other part of it was a reaction to the recession. You had a lot of people kind of looking around and saying, okay, I don't have a lot of money. What can I live without? We've all been on this sort of nationwide shopping binge. Is there a better way to get dressed? So I've seen a lot of new ethical fashion retailers, fashion designers, and even the fast fashion chains are coming out with ethical alternatives to their products as well.
So I've also heard these stories about sweatshops and toxic dyes, and I try
right.
to be a careful shopper. Also, I am on a public radio salary, which means I don't have a lot mm-hmm. of money to spend.
Right.
I love beautiful garments, but particularly not living in a big city, it feels like there's no option for me.
Yeah, that's part of the problem that I describe in Overdressed is in the era of fast fashion, we've chased the alternatives out of the market. But I think what's happening now is you have a lot of ethical retailers that are opening up online. I think the slow fashion movement is probably 15 years behind the food movement. So hopefully down the road, we'll have, you know, a Whole Foods or Trader Joe's of fashion.
So it sounds like you think that Americans are a little more willing to pay more for clothes than they were 5 years ago?
Yeah, I think Americans, I think they're very savvy shoppers in the sense that they want value. They're not going to pay more for something if it's not worth more. But if something is made in the U.S., it's made ethically, and it's made out of good materials, and it has a good story associated with it, they'll absolutely pay more for it. And then a couple years ago, or maybe it was just last year, this fashion trend emerged called normcore, where it was just this complete rejection of fashion where people were just like, you know what, I'm just going to wear like acid wash jeans from the 90s and like a plain t-shirt and sneakers, and I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to follow the trends anymore, which I thought was really, really funny and also part of the backlash that's happening against fast fashion.
You know, over the course of this hour, we've been talking about how it's not uncommon for people to dismiss fashion as frivolous and something not worthy of consideration. And I think in your book, you make a good case for, listen, it has enormous environmental and economic consequences for us. It's a huge industry. But I also wonder if that kind of dismissal of fashion is a roadblock to actually getting people to pay closer attention to where their clothes are coming from.
Yeah, I think that the fact that clothing is so cheap now is part of the reason why it's considered to be frivolous. And the reality is it's a $1 trillion global industry. And Americans especially spend an enormous amount of time shopping and consuming clothing. And I think that one of the things that is so joyous and fulfilling about the slow fashion movement, it just adds to the experience of getting dressed. If you know the story behind what you're wearing, who made it, how it was made, and trying to convey that to a wider population, it's been sort of a roadblock, but I think that roadblock also existed in the food movement. And then basically what we needed was somebody like Michael Pollan from Omnivore's Dilemma to come along and say, you know what, there's actually a much more fulfilling, enriching way to think about food.
What you're saying reminds me of a dress that was handed down to me from a friend, and she had had it handed down to her from her husband's mother. And it's this beautiful chiffon floral 1920s dress. And it is a precious object for me because I know the story and because I can see the quality. Maybe that's what slow fashion is, having those objects, those garments, be precious.
Absolutely. I think the connection that you're describing there is something that's been lost. But I feel like even, you know, somebody that almost their entire closet is full of cheap clothes, they probably have that one thing like you're describing that, you know, they inherited from someone or was handed down to them or they wore to a special occasion that they're never going to throw away. They do have that feeling about something in their closet. And imagine if that's the way you felt about everything you owned.
Elizabeth Klein's book about fast fashion and its alternatives is called Overdressed. She talked with Sarah Nix. If you're curious about how to get your hands on responsible fashions, visit our website, ttbook.org, for a list of suggestions. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. People who study ancient religions do not often get death threats, unless they're Wendy Doniger. She's one of the most important scholars of Hindu religion in the world. She's got PhDs in Sanskrit and Indian studies from both Harvard and Oxford. But the one country in the world she can't visit is India. Doniger's work has come under attack from Hindu nationalists and from India's ruling right-wing party, the BJP. Her most recent book, called The Hindus, An Alternative History, is so controversial in India that her publisher there has pulled it out of circulation and then destroyed all the remaining copies. Doniger gets death threats from India, and she no longer feels safe visiting there. But as she told Steve Paulson, her writing about Hinduism hasn't changed in over 40 years. What has changed is India itself.
I got away with it for about 40 years. When I think back of the first book I wrote 40 years ago, 71, Shiva, the Erotic Ascetic. Obviously, no one in the government of India has read this book because this stuff about the sexuality of the gods and that, mocking the gods and so forth. So I've been writing about this sort of material now for a long time, and no one minded until the last 10 years or so.
So what happened 10 years ago?
India changed. Well, the world changed. I think that what's happening in India is part of a wave of religious fundamentalism that we know about here in America with the Christians, that we're seeing in Israel, that we know, of course, notoriously in Islam. Even the Buddhists are misbehaving. Everyone thinks that the Buddhists never do anything. And it's happening to Hinduism, too. So I think they've caught it from an international, global movement, which is not simply religion against religion, the old Hindu-Muslim thing. That's an old problem. But Hindu against Hindu, that's fundamentalism. That's where certain Hindus have started to vigorously disapprove of other aspects of their own religion. And that's where I come in for trouble, because I'm writing about aspects of Hinduism that Hindu nationalists, the BJP party, fundamentalists, fundus is what my Indian publisher calls them, the fundus, they don't like that aspect of their own religion.
Now, we should say that you are not being attacked because of what you're saying about current politics, at least not directly.
No.
I mean, you're a historian of religion.
That's
you're a
right.
historian of Hinduism. I mean, you're talking about sacred texts that were written centuries ago.
I'm talking about the Ramayana, which was composed 200 BC, 200 CE, and saying that there's a passage in the Ramayana in which Sita accuses her brother-in-law Lakshman of desiring her. That's there in the Sanskrit text. This is not acceptable. You're not allowed to say that. It implies that Sita and Rama and Lakshman, who are simply epic characters in the ancient period, who have now become deified. Rama is a god and his wife is a goddess. And the version of that story of how Rama and Sita went into the forest with Rama's brother Lakshman is told in only one way by the Hindu nationalists. And it leaves out a great deal of detail that's in the ancient Sanskrit epic, which makes them more complicated human beings with frailties and flaws. And that's the wrong way to tell that story. There was an essay by the great A.K. Ramanujan, a much greater scholar than I am, who had written a famous essay called Many Ramayanas, about all the different ways there are to tell the story of Rama and Sita and Lakshman. And it was on the history syllabus in Delhi. And this crowd, about 5 years ago, got it off the history syllabus.
But why? I mean, why is there such concern about these texts that were written centuries ago, millennia ago?
History matters. History really matters. If you read history in certain ways in India today, it means that the Muslims should leave. I mean, they're reading the Muslims out of Indian history. They're reading the Muslims out of India. They're trying to make India a Hindu nation. And that takes some tricks with history.
I mean, there are a lot of Muslims, obviously, who live in India.
There are a lot of Muslims, a lot of people doing it. Thousands of people were killed when they tore down a mosque, a great mosque, the Babri Mosque, the mosque of the Emperor Babur near Delhi in Ayodhya, because the textbooks, the Sanskrit texts say that that's where Rama was born. Well, Rama is not like Jesus. Rama is like Adam. Rama is really an ancient mythological figure. To say that he was born there is a non-historical statement. But the statement that he was born there meant that they tore down the mosque and the Hindu police simply stood by and watched while mobs tore down one of the great ancient mosques of India, and people were killed on both sides and there were reactions. It set off riots. And that was about history. That was about what happened in a mythological place. Another example of history, the story is that Rama built a bridge to a mythical island called Lanka, which is now identified with Sri Lanka. And the Indian government wanted to cut away some coral formations that make a kind of a barrier between the island of Sri Lanka and India, and ships have to go all around it. A lot of money, a lot of gasoline is wasted and so forth, a lot of oil. So they wanted to cut through there. But the Hindu nationalists said, no, that's where Rama built the bridge. And they succeeded in stopping that project. There is no canal through that area. Ships still have to go all the way around Sri Lanka to get to the other side of India. So history is being used to change the present in all sorts of ways.
So this is obviously serious business politically, and it's also serious for scholars like yourself. I mean, to the point where you have to be careful because scholars have been threatened and have they been killed as well?
One man was killed. There was a big article about it, a man who's been a Hindu man, So, you know, this is about I'm a woman and I'm an American. There are problems I have to deal with specifically, but a Hindu man was killed.
For what?
Writing against what he calls the idolatrous aspects of Hinduism. He disapproved of the superstitions and doing worship of idols and so forth and so. So he criticized a lot of contemporary Hinduism. And he was murdered, and other writers have been hurt, and publishers' offices have been ransacked, and computers smashed. So in India, people are getting really badly hurt physically. In America, I worry that my students and younger scholars who don't have tenure are simply changing what they are writing about. They're not going to get visas. They're not going to get tenure. They're not going to get their books published in India. That there's a kind of self-censorship going on because people are so scared, not that they'll be killed or maimed, but that simply they will not succeed in their academic work. So there's a whole gamut, a whole range of problems from physical violence to just people dropping the study of India and taking up the study of ancient Greece instead.
Now, this is a complicated story. I mean, there are obviously different, sometimes competing interpretations of Hinduism, as there are in every major religion. And there's also the history of how particular Hindu sacred texts have become canonized and others rejected. And you've traced this back to the British colonial rule in India. What happened?
Well, Indian history begins long before the British. Many things happened before the British ever got to India. By the time the British came, there were many different sorts of sacred texts in India and many different sorts of Hindus that use one text or another. When the British came to India, they wanted to find a Hindu Bible and they wanted to have a unified Hinduism that they could deal with as a whole, in contrast with the way they would deal with Islam as a whole, and Islam had the Quran. These were also the British Protestants, so they were a bit anti-Catholic. So they were book people rather than ritual people, and they wanted to know what is your book. And they got some Brahmins in Bengal, which was where the British really began, to say that their book was the Bhagavad Gita. So the British said, great, that's the Hindu Bible. And so that statement by the British was picked up by a certain kind of Hindu, a certain branch of Hindus beginning in Bengal in Calcutta, and formed a new kind of so-called reform Hinduism, or Sanatana Dharma, as it's sometimes called, which is just a particular branch of Hinduism, which was the Hinduism of people who spoke English and people who had positions of power under the Raj and so forth. And that one branch of Hinduism now is part of the BJP program, and everything is the Bhagavad Gita, whereas the Bhagavad Gita is one of just a number of texts.
Are there certain strains of Hinduism that were kind of shut out, or is there a kind of a particular interpretation of Hinduism that has become then dominant?
There is the Hinduism of the ascetic tradition, the meditation tradition, the yoga tradition, which is misogynist, which is largely Brahmin. It's anti the lower castes. It's anti-ritual. It's anti-sexual. It's very sanitized. It's a particular kind of Hinduism which is being lifted up as the right kind of Hinduism. And the other Hinduisms, the Hinduism of goat sacrifices, which still go on all the time in India, the Hinduism of people who eat meat, and most Hindus actually are not vegetarians, and many of them eat beef. The idea that no Hindus eat beef is a political statement. It's not a historical statement. The sexual carvings on the temples, the great temples of Khajuraho and Konark, the Kama Sutra, the temple dancers, the dancing girls. The British got the dancing girls out of the temples, and now that's part of the sanitized version of Hinduism. So there's a whole lot of Hinduism that I like best, the Hinduism of satire, the Hinduism of violence, sometimes religious violence, the Hinduism of imagination, of sexuality, mocking the gods. All of that is simply written off as not the real Hinduism. And anyone who produces examples of it, writes about it, exalts it, is doing a bad thing.
So what has all of this meant for you? I assume you are at some risk if you go out in public. I mean, do you even go to India?
I can't go to India right now because I am technically in contempt of court. I was served with a summons when this became a criminal case, and the Indian lawyer said, don't answer the summons. It was sent to the provost office at the University of Chicago because there's no extradition. And so I did not testify at any point because I can't go to India. So at the moment, I'm legally unable to go to India. I also would be stupid to go to India because it would be, I think, dangerous for me. Outside of India, I don't feel that I'm in danger. I have security when I speak in public, but that's...
I mean, you are often heckled when you're...
That's it.
When you
I have security because the people who come, they ruin the question and answer period, and they have to be escorted out so that we can have a serious discussion. But I get heckled, and so there's security to prevent that happening.
Given the sensitivity of some of these people who have objected against your book, who say that, you know, this is salacious, this history. I mean, it's like overly sexualized. Why push it? Why not just step back and say, okay, this is offensive to some people. It's not worth going there. I'll just let it go.
Oh, but it is worth it. It is worth it. If you're a historian, you're a historian, you want to show people what really is there. Secondly, it's wonderful. I mean, the Hindu attitude to sexuality is so brilliant and so much better than the history of sexuality in Judaism or Islam or Christianity. I mean, the Abrahamic religions have not done nearly so well with sexuality as Hinduism has. Kama Sutra is a fabulous book. It's a book of deep understanding of the importance of sexuality in human life. There's just a great deal to be learned from it.
And the Kama Sutra is a sacred text?
The Kama Sutra is not a sacred text,
okay.
No.
Mm-hmm.
I quoted it to show that in ancient India there was an openness and a celebration of sexuality unlike anything that there was in Europe until the 19th century practically. No, that's not a sacred text. But in the sacred text, the Veda, this most ancient text, there are wonderful passages about sexuality. So first of all, I want the world to know how good Hinduism is. How much better Hinduism is than any of the Abrahamic religions, how much more profound it is about human psychology, how much more interesting it is. So I think it's a good thing, and I think it's to the credit of the Hindus that they have this. Secondly, if you're writing a book about something, you have to tell what it's like. What's the point of writing a book if you're going to say, I'm only going to tell you a little piece because the rest of it is going to make some people mad?
It's a remarkable story. Thank you for coming in, for talking about all of this.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on the program.
That's Wendy Doniger with Steve Paulson. Wendy's a professor of history of religion at the University of Chicago. Her most recent book is Hindus, an Alternative History. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show. He had help from Sarah Nix, Raymond Tangekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.